I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And in this episode, I'm going to look at some of the events from 1945 onwards in America that lay the kind of groundwork for the anti-communist era that lasts until the mid-1950s. And normally it's common to look at a sort of a rather top-down approach in this period of time of various parts of the political establishment persecuting a wide range of figures on the left during the kind of the earliest and the most intense phase of the Cold War. But here, what I want to do is look at tensions within the trade union movement. I always find that examining divisions and schisms within the left is really, really instructive when you're looking at the politics of democratic societies. Now, previously on this podcast, we looked at the Taft-Hartley Act and the impact that that had had on organised labour in the late 1940s. And we looked at Truman's antipathy towards the trade union movement. Truman vacillated between outright hostility and a belief that the trade unions and pay bargaining in general was some kind of treachery, all the way through to feeling that in some instances the anti-union laws had gone too far and some of the working class base of the Democrat Party was threatened as a result. In the late 1940s, the unions attempted to break the power of anti-union bosses in the most de-unionised, politically right and pro-employer part of America, which was the South. The AFL and the CIO, the two umbrella union bodies, both had their go at trying to break anti-union power in the South. The CIO spent $1 million and took on 200 organisers in 1946-47. And pursued what was referred to colloquially as Operation Dixie in order to extend its interests and the interests of workers in the South. At the beginning of Operation Dixie, the textile industry in the South, obviously the South being kind of the main cotton-producing region in the country, along with state governments, organised a firmly united front against the CIO. the other main body in the South, the other main sort of employers grouping in the South were agricultural, the agricultural industry, farmers and large agribusinesses. Also united in order to prevent there being any kind of workers' movement developing. And this was this intersects with racist sentiments in the South, racist tradition, the racist traditions of the South, and employers and anti-union politicians draw powerfully on the racist sentiments of white workers, using all sorts of arguments to put forward to the white working class that trade union membership would give black workers the upper hand over white workers, or that white workers would be reduced to the kind of the same servile level as their black counterparts. And the CIO was associated with the civil rights movement. Probably inaccurately, there was little to suggest in the AFL and the CIO that they wanted equality between white and black workers, but it was a useful ploy for driving wedges between white and black workers in the South. In Birmingham in Alabama, which was obviously a steel city, white steel workers were united in rejecting the demands of the local black workers there, who had organised in a under a communist trade union, the mill, the mine, mill, and smelt workers union. In Mark Nyson's brilliant book Black Communists in Harlem during the 1930s. He makes it clear that the Communist Party in Harlem and communist trade unions were, for black workers, really the only show in town. It was the only political organisation, the communists, that was likely to treat black workers with anything approaching equality. Unions that were dominated by white workers, which didn't have the kind of radical emancipatory politics that the communists had, were often mired in racial politics. The idea that this union should be for exclusively for white working class men, and that white working class men weren't in the business of fighting for the rights for poor, lower paid blacks who would be able to undercut them. These are kind of popular ideas. By 1948, it was abundantly clear that Operation Dixie hadn't worked. Unions in the South had smaller percentages of non-agricultural labour by 1955 than they'd had in 1945. So actually union membership had gone down. And one thing that became abundantly clear from these struggles in the South was that a schism within the trade union movement had opened up. It wasn't simply that the trade union movement per se was accused of being communist by their detractors. It's that within the trade union movement, there were communist and non-communist unions, and non-communist and non-communist union leaders, and therefore the union movement itself would become one of the battlegrounds for the coming domestic Cold War in America, and the fears of communist subversion would be focused on, in part, on the trade union movement. By 1945, there were a number of unions, including the United Electrical Workers, the International Longshoremen's Union, and the National Maritime Union, the Mine, Mill, and Smelters Workers Union, which either had communist leaders or followed the Soviet Party line on political and economic issues. Of course, if you were part of a communist party, you were by extension going to be part of the Communist International and take your lead from Comintern, which was an incredibly fraught and politically dangerous path to tread in 1945, when all of a sudden, not just the government, but popular opinion shifts towards the political right, and a deep suspicion and antipathy towards the Soviet Union emerges. The superficial bonds and affections of the wartime alliances, which were only ever surface, never ran particularly deeply, these are swept away. Most of the communist unions were affiliated to the CIO. 12 of the 35 CIO affiliates in 1946 had communist or strongly pro-Soviet leadership, and a million workers belonged to these unions. So from the paranoid perspective of anti-communists in Washington, there seemed to be an awful lot to be concerned or worried about. But also in the AFL and the CIO, there were popular, well-known, well-established and charismatic union leaders such as Walter Reuther, who had run-ins over the last two decades with communist trade unionists and found them to be doctrinaire and untrustworthy and belligerent and suspicious and all the kinds of things that really split the labour movement. The non-communist left, democratic socialists, and those on the left, generally on the left of the Democrat Party, also found their dealings with communist trade unionists extremely difficult. These were union officials who took their cue from Moscow and were uncompromising in the party line. In 1947 and 48, as the Cold War really develops, you have events such as the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan and the Berlin Airlift, the schisms in the labour movement become much deeper and occasionally violent. One leading trade union wrote to the CIO, trade unionist wrote to the CIO executive board saying, "If communism is an issue in your unions, throw it the hell out, and throw its advocates out along with it." And the following year, communists, the same correspondent wrote to the CIO, referring to communists as sulking cowards, apostles of hate, and dirty, filthy traitors. The CIO, in 1949, expelled 11 unions and disaffiliating them. And these comprised of 900,000 workers or 900,000 union members. What was the case in most of these unions is that there were a significant number, if not a majority, of union members who were themselves not communists, who did not either A, have any interest in what the line, the party line coming from Moscow was, or B, if they did have any interest, agree with it in any way, shape or form. The political leadership of most of these trade unions was not representative of the right.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Rank and file membership. But even worse, the existence of communist trade unions or trade unions led by communists enabled later on the likes of Senator McCarthy to allege that the trade union movement in general was either soft on communism or complicit in the crimes of communism. And because of this, it allowed the more paranoic and authoritarian figures in the anti-communist witch hunt to suggest that the union movement was an example of internal subversion, that the union movement was therefore for dangerous, and it also allowed this idea to spread to other aspects of worker solidarity. And the reality was that there was a very small number of communists amongst the trade union movement, but it, by pretending or alleging or claiming that the communism was widespread, it gave opportunities to suggest that any kind of worker solidarity was dangerous troublemaking and potentially gave opportunities to the USSR. And this played neatly into the hands of employers who were happy to accept a de-unionised workforce in the 1940s and 50s. The expulsion of communists from the CIO and the disaffiliation of communist-led unions from the CIO was a deliberate ploy by the CIO to appear in the early years of the Cold War as far away from Soviet communism as possible. The only problem is that the Purge unions, their leaders, had been elected by democratic vote of the members. And therefore, what the CIA was doing was fundamentally undemocratic. One of the activists, Paul Jacobs, who rather reluctantly supported the Purges, said that, and I quote, "All serious debate within the CIO came to a standstill. In some unions, it became a habit to brand as a communist anyone who opposed the leaders." And by the mid-1950s, the spirit of anti-communism had swept all before it within the union movement. And anti-communists were in control of the labour movement across America. The unions thereafter, instead of being organisations of worker solidarity for collective pay bargaining, and instead of being able to support one another across industries, you know, present the threat even of general strike in the future, unions became much weaker organisations, and instead of pursuing broadly pro-working class left-wing ideas, they became what James Patterson describes as special interest groups rather than supporters of broad-based liberal ideas. And so they also become a weakened force within national politics. The trade union movements in Europe and America in the 1930s were active in demands for broad social reform. After World War II, because of the spectre of Soviet communism in America, at least, that comes to something of a halt. Within the Democratic Party in industrial areas, unions were kind of a hostage to the Democratic Party. Obviously, they were the Republican Party were utterly hostile towards the trade unions, and the Democrats less so, but the unions became far more dependent upon them, and they were unable to really engage in politics without the Democrats. In rural areas and among black Americans, working women, and other non-unionized Americans, there was little influence. And it was social reformers in America who argued that the decline of union power in the 1940s and 50s was part of the reason for a kind of renewed conservatism in the 1950s, and part of the reason why social reform takes a significant step back during that period of time, and only really to be kind of reinvigorated during the 1960s. The irony of this period is that at the end of the Second World War and the death of Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal was by and large highly thought of. Its critics had been silenced by Roosevelt's war record, and it was entirely possible that a liberal and social democratic age would dominate. There was nothing to suggest that at the end of the Cold War that the population would at the end of the Second World War, I beg your pardon, that the population would shift to the right, and there was nothing to suggest that liberalism, the American conception of liberalism, which I suppose you could describe as social democracy, there was nothing to suggest that that wouldn't be in the ascendancy in the 40s and 50s. A majority of the population supported not only the Democrats, but the broad principles of the New Deal, having seen the effectiveness during peacetime and in war of state intervention. And the arguments about a free market, a deregulated free market economy, hadn't really managed to kind of re-implant themselves in popular consciousness and wouldn't do for another generation. The Democrats were able to count on loyalty from minorities, from rural minorities, black people, the working classes, from trade unionists, Jews and Catholics. And all of these minorities have significant voting clout. The Democrats, however, were starting to see, very gradually at the end of the Second World War, falling voter turnout. And Truman himself was no Roosevelt. He didn't have the elan and the charm of Roosevelt, and was certainly immensely disliked mid-term by many of the groups that I've just cited, particularly the trade unionists, for very good reasons, as we've seen in the last few podcasts on this topic area. So Truman did endorse the New Deal and his own Fair Deal, and yet he was becoming gradually less and less popular with the traditional Democrat base. The Republicans, of course, get the unequivocal support of their normal backers, the American business classes, and also have the conservative or Southern Democrats in the House, who would ally with the Republicans to undermine progressive measures, and had done during the 1930s. The idea that the state was able to solve problems was still firmly an article of faith in 1945, and would be probably up until the 1970s, when a right-wing counter-revolution takes place under Ronald Reagan, with these various kind of Ayn Randian sort of notions. And the GI Bill was, and I've talked about this in previous podcasts, the GI Bill was an extraordinary example of how state intervention and the granting of state subsidies to returning GIs in terms of cheap house loans and loans for to set up businesses and to pursue educations had a massively revitalizing effect on the economy. So given the fact that this was an almost left of centre republic, how did the elements of McCarthyism and the anti-communist era take hold? Well, as with all conservative with a small c counter-revolutions, persistence is the key. Within the political, economic, governmental and media elites, there are always figures who believe in, if not in a smaller state, then in certainly a more authoritarian state that has the power to intervene and to monitor and to curtail rights when necessary. If you think that later on, the kind of the Reaganite right of the late 70s and early 80s believe in rolling back the state, the extreme economic right in that regard is very, very much fringe in the 50s and 60s. However, the extreme authoritarian statist right, the likes of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, for example, these are the figures that really are in ascendancy on the right in the 1940s and 50s. And they actually have the levers of state control and a greatly expanded bureaucracy in order to achieve their aims. Now, I'm going to finish here, and we're going to continue in the next few weeks on looking at the origins of McCarthyism. You can find out some of my long-form journalism on the Explaining History Patreon page. I've put a few long articles on there about matters various recently. If you can go there, check it out, and obviously any patrons are greatly appreciated. It helps the podcast to keep going. And I'll look forward to speaking to you all soon, and feel free to say hi at the Explaining History Podcast Facebook group. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.